Tesla. I sort of semi-apologize again that I'd speak more here than any place else, probably because simply it's my heritage, it's my legacy, but B'cholofen, it's everybody's in a certain sense. So we spoke about, like when we spoke in Volozhin about two different things coinciding, the Rabbanim and the Yeshivas. Really there are two things here, there's Kavna and Slabatka, and both of them are two worlds, and it's important to have a sense of each one. Kavna represented a sort of old time, and like you see a very strong identification with Yiddishkeit. The Litvisha Yid was a very controlled, his emotions were controlled, but they were deep. They had very strong and deep emotions, a very strong sense of tradition, a strong sense of respect, a bit of skepticism and cynicism, and tradition meant a lot. Digduk halacha did not mean much. And Kovna represented the big city, the people who had gone to universities, had not gone to yeshivas, people who basically they didn't believe in the detailed obligation of Torah and halacha, but had strong Yiddish identification. And that's why you'll see the signs in Yiddish here. He speaks Yiddish. There's a desire to keep a shul like this, they didn't make the changes. Reform did not have a really foothold here. The drastic changes in the shuls they were not into. There was a sense of keeping things with a certain, dignity and so on and so forth. The Rabbanim in the big cities tried dearly to, they basically were keeping Kehillas going, and World War I knocked it out. This an article I have about Vilna, and he says that the difference was incredible. Many people were not into keeping kosher anymore, but everything was kosher. So you ate kosher, you did kosher, and that was it. But during World War I, they had to eat treif. There was nothing else to eat. There was starvation, there was no rabbanim. Everything was hefka. If they got used to 3 or 4 years of treif and meat, you no longer had that sentimental attachment to kosher. You no longer had a red line against bringing treif chaza. So they didn't eat chaza, but everything else they ate without shchit and nevelas and so on and so forth. Chol Shabbos. Before World War I, it was not the norm to be chol Shabbos. During the war, the Germans forced people to keep the stores open, b'chulu, b'chulu. And then, so after the war, before World War I and after World War I, in places like Kovna and Vilna, were drastic changes. Because the Kehillah had become disbanded, because the Rabbanim were no longer didn't have a grip on the Kehillah, they came back after 5-6 years, a new generation came, and that was part of the churban of these places. South African Jewry was very typical of many Litvish Yidin went there. The South African Litvish Yidin loved to learn. They dropped Shmiras and Mitzvahs in any real sense of the word when they came there. The shuls in the community was Orthodox. When you came to a shul, you came to an Orthodox shul. That was your shul. And there was a sense of respect. I told over before in the bus, I was there last year. And the rabbi there, Rabbi Goldstein, has made these Shabbos for everybody. In America, it's very difficult to get going. In South Africa, the rabbi said how they should do it. People who are not shayim and mitzvahs, everyone comes, they don't drive, and they sleep over in a building, in a school building, because the rabbi said that's where you do Shabbos. And I'll pull up an anecdote, but I was there last year, and I was speaking for a group of students who were totally not from. And it's called Awesome. It's Eisha Torah's Kirov, whatever it is. So I took a look around. It was late at night. It was left a long day for me, and it looked like after a long night for them. Nobody was in the mood. So I said, I'll take questions and answers. So nobody volunteered. So I said, let me ask you some questions. I'm interested in things. I'm curious. I said, why do you belong to a Jewish organization? So they thought a minute, the girl stepped up, and she said, we all went to Jewish schools. We have common identification with certain basic Jewish things, and that keeps us, that's our common denominator. So I said, tell me 3 things that you feel are basic Jewish traits. So she said, caring for each other. Okay, that I would have heard in America, would have heard anywhere else. The second thing she said was respect. And I said, wow. I said, in America, that's a four-letter word. I mean, what do you mean respect? You question. And I can class is a hero, not somebody who's traditional and respects. And I told her, you know, I learned something from you. And it's true. You get a certain, a Rav gets a deference and a certain sense of this is how it should be, which is very helpful in certain circumstances. That was the neshama of, that was a little sheet. The video that he has of the person saying Avinu Malkeinu, it's heart-wrenching. It's that type of deep regish. I don't know what this person was doing, but you know, the pneumias of the person is incredible. I was in Phoenix many years ago. There was an old Irat English to
okay,
Abyssal. There was an old Litvish Yid who was in his 90s. I forgot his name, obviously, I don't remember. And they told me, come into shul early and watch him come in and daven. Watch him come. So he comes in before davening. This is a weekday davening. And he stands by the door and he says, you know, Vani Berev Chastecha Ovo Beisecha Shtach Vadech Kotchecha Shtach Beiro Secha. And he mamash trembled and he jumped in. And I, wow. Later on, he used to lay for them. They realized that on Shabbos, it's impossible that he walks 10 miles from where he lives. And so they, you know, he said, listen, I've kept Shabbos longer than all you together. You know, you're all 20 years old, five of you. And they got him an apartment next to the show. But there was a certain pneumistic erection. That's why Chabad appealed. That type of, you know, not to be sentimentally awash, but to focus a very deep inside identification. That was a Litvishi Yid, that was the... Now let's switch to... So in a certain sense, there was a process of degeneration setting in. People were going less to study yeshivas, they're studying universities, there was less and less and less Yiddishkeit and Dikta Gemitzes and so on and so forth. Rabbi Sol Salanter, people don't realize his, if you had to ask yourself, what is the shoresh of what he was trying to do? The answer was Kiruv. He realized things are falling apart. He started with Musa, that was his primary main, but he did many other things. He wanted to translate the Talmud into German or French, I don't remember which one. He spent his last years living in France, Germany, and people were very upset. People didn't know what happened. And he gave a mashal. He said, when a horse and a wagon are going downhill, if you try to stop them, you will. If you put the brakes on, like we heard yesterday, you go flying over. But if you, once they're downhill, you can slowly get them uphill. He said, Poland, Russia, and Litva are going downhill. I can't do much. Over there, in Germany and France, the rock bottom, maybe I can lift them up. So Rabbi Sol was really, in a certain sense, he was interested in the Jewish Renaissance. And that's why Musa was primarily going to be a movement for Balabatim. They would reconnect emotionally with Yiddishkeit. That's really, if you look and read and see what he says. Rabbi Sol Salanter's own mitzias, he was such a gadol b'Torah, such a brilliant gadol. He was so beloved, respected, that nobody would say things about him or against him. So Rabbi Sol Salanter himself never got opposition. The one that they, when they want to speak of Sol Salanter, they spoke of Yisrael Peterberg, or sometimes the Alta. But Lemaisa, Rabbi Sol Salanter formulated his Musa movement, and he came to Kovna to make his Musa. That was the first place where he really made one. But before that, the Alta Slabodka was born in 49. He was born in a small town, and he was a younger man. He was in his early 20s. When somebody got him to meet the Alta Kelim. He heard the Alta of Kelim, and he spent the whole night, he said, crying on his pillow, and he was a different person. He became a Bal Musa. He looked at the Alta Kelim as a Rebbe of his. They together made different things. They made a Talmud Torah and Gravine and other things. They split. They didn't see eye to eye on certain things. Not clear what, whatever it was. They were two big people, they didn't see eye to eye. And the Alta came to Kovna. And he's, now the Alta Slabodka, his first meter was, it's my wife's great-grandfather, his first meter was that he was totally hidden. He was hidden, remained hidden. No one knows anything about his biography, knows anything about him. Anything that he said, it's because he wanted people to hear. He had no, most people need to talk to get something off their chest, to get recognition, to get acknowledgement. You're a person, he wasn't. Nothing that he ever said had any reason, unless it was to get somebody to do something, to tell somebody something. That was him. His Talmidim never knew anything about him, and his biography is skimpier than skimpy. And they talk about the yeshivas. He was extraordinarily, he was a person who was an extreme strategist. He came to Kovna and he slowly began. He first started with a little bit of a kolel. Then there was a yeshiva for young boys of Hirshel Levitan. And I think it was called Reb Hirsch de Mechalek. That's what they spoke about him. He had a yeshiva young boys. The Alta started speaking to the boys. And that slowly became a feat for yeshiva. Every place there was something going on, the Alta put a foot in, and he slowly began to draw the threads together. Now you have to understand, this was incredibly pressing. I mean, people didn't realize how everything was going to fall apart. It was still the end of the 1800s, mid to end of 1800s, but he realized it's falling apart. It's not going to work. You have to reconstruct the yeshiva. And he slowly began building Slabodka Yeshiva through the kolo that he had. He had them learn with some of the boys. The boys became older. He started making a group. And slowly it evolved into the yeshiva. This was the official date for when the yeshiva is founded is 1877. That's the kolo. And he brought in Reb Itzel Lapanovitcher to be Rosh Yeshiva. That was in 1889. Reb Itzel Lapanovitcher was a sort of Reb Chaim-like personality. He was Mechadish Torah that was extremely attractive. Bracham liked it. Slowly began building the yeshiva. And this is typical of him. As he built the yeshiva, no one knew what his job was. No one knew exactly what he was doing. The Rosh Yeshiva was one person. The Mashkiach was the second person. This was that. And he was the behind-the-scenes boss. He raised the money. He had a lot of money came from somebody named Vadi Lachman. He had money coming in. He brought the money, took responsibility. He brought in people to yeshiva, kept people out of yeshiva. And it was like one of these things where he had no, that's why they called him the Alta. There was nothing else to call him. There was no other title because he had no official title in yeshiva. So he was everything and nobody. Reb Moshe Mordechai was the official of yeshiva later on. But slowly he began weaving the yeshiva into a yeshiva. His principles were, he took Rosh Yeshivas that were attractive for Bachram, like the same way the Chavetz Chaim took Rav Toli, he took Reb Itzel Lapanovitcher, he then took Reb Moshe Mordechai and Reb Yisrael Zalman. He looked for Rosh Yeshivas that would attract Bachram with the new Derech HaLimud. He understood that you need that. He put a Ruach of Musa, people learn Musa, and he worked with the Bachram one by one. He especially was focused on Balei Kishonos. He felt that they would become the next door of Manhigim Gdolim. And he with each one he had a different agenda. Some of them he let do things, some he didn't let do things, some of them he pulled back, some he pushed. He was incredibly astute in knowing how to deal with each one. That's why if you look at a specific derech, it's hard to say a derech, because some Bachrim he let them go to university quietly. My father-in-law told me that Rav Huta's going to university for a few months. He felt, again, my father-in-law said, I can't tell you for sure, but the Alta was a nod and a wink of the Alta, because the Alta felt he would lose him without that. So by sort of giving him the sense that he's royal to go and this and that, he got over it and came back. That was the type of things that the Alta could think of. Who needs to be told no way, and who needs to be told yes, because he's going to come back and it would go wrong the other night. A big event occurred at the end of the 1890s, 1898, 99, 97, those years. So Musa was something that was a new movement. The Bachrim who were affected by it did not like it. In other words, there were Bachrim, there was Merachik because of it, and you know, that whole thing. And in the yeshiva, they developed an opposition to it. And they brought things to a head by getting Rabbanim involved. Rabbanim also didn't see it always by Ein Yafa. So as long as Reb Yitzchak Hanan was alive, Reb Yitzchak Hanan, he wasn't affiliated with the Muslim movement, but he trusted the people and he felt whatever it is, it's good. His son did not see it that way, and Reb Hirsch Rabinowitz was the Rav at this time already, and he called an Asif of Rabbanim and he invited Reb Nosson Zvi Finkel and Reb Itzel Petterberger to come and defend Musa. So they got, the Rabbanim got up, they lambasted Musa, and then they asked them to reply. Reb Itzel Petterberger got up and he said, "Good night, everybody." And the altar nodded and they walked out. And the altar was a little bit upset with Reb Itzel. "Why didn't you talk to him?" Reb Itzel was a noted Talmud Chacham. The altar hid his learning. Reb Itzel Petterberger had written a Sfarim and he was Chashev and learned. He said, "I'm not a Chasim Bacha that they need to hear the Joshua to see how much I'm worth." They both decided there's no point in arguing because no one's listening. They've made up their mind. Nothing else they convinced them. They got up and they left the yeshiva. They got up and walked out. The majority of Bachurim remained, and they took 70 Bachurim went with them, and they remade a new yeshiva. They named the new yeshiva Knesset Yisrael after Yisrael Salanta, and the old yeshiva was Knesset Yitzchak after Yitzchak Hanan. The altar had to rebuild from scratch, but he didn't want to make machlokas, so he rebuilt from scratch. They wanted the yeshiva, take the yeshiva. I'm there to build. And he rebuilt from scratch. He allowed Bochum, they took Rebbe Ochperos, which is Shiva of Knesset Yitzchak. He allowed Bochum to go hear him. Rebbe Ochperos was Kodesh Kedashim by him. And vice versa. He would be on the lookout for Bochum of Knesset Yitzchak that he would pull in, you know, to the Musa and so on and so forth. And both yeshivas coexisted before World War One. After World War One, the Knesset Yitzchak never came back again. Rebbe Ochperos went off, you know, through all the Golos, and he went off, and that was that. So that was the yeshiva until World War One. World War One, the yeshiva scattered. They went off to Minsk first. Minsk was a big place where a lot of yeshivas went to. That was like the first, like I told you, because they had the forts around Kovna, the Tsar was especially very, very nervous that the Jews should be there, and that's why he sent them off. That was so he sent the Jews, he pushed to exile them. He took the Jews, put them in trains. My father remembered it. And my father told me almost every stop that the train stopped, the Jews of the communities came and they brought them food and drink. And he could see them wiping away tears, like they were very mishtater b'tzaron. It was incredible. And then they went first to that, they ended up in Kremenchuk. They were pushed far into Russia. Some ended up in Ukraine, different kufis of where it was safer and less safe. They came back, the yeshivas had to rebuild again. There were other, like we spoke in the beginning, there were a lot of problems because some people had stayed and so on and so forth. The yeshiva regrouped, rebuilt, and it's reached its heydays like every other yeshiva in the 20s. Most of the famous names you heard were from the 20s. And probably he had a hand in almost every yeshiva that there was in what we call Litta. He was an incredible person. He helped build Tel's yeshiva before he even had Slabodka. He built Slabodka. His son, Rabbi Zudel, went to the Mir. He sent 14 Baruchim to start Kletsk. He helped Rabbi Shimon in Malchin and Bryansk. He wanted, A, there should be more Torah. B, he felt that by bringing in the right people, they would spread Musa everywhere. Bekachave, of the Rosh Yeshivas in America, Reb Aaron Kotler was a brilliant beyond words person. He wavered. In other words, he was a yassam, and his family wanted him to go study university. The altar had 101 tricks how to get him to stay. He got him to stay, spent all his focus on him, and Reb Aaron Kotler brought her to America. He helped build Tel's yeshiva. The Mir was Reb Lezula. Reb Lezula himself wasn't a Bal Musa per se, but he understood that the yeshiva needs Musa, and he always had a mashgiach. He created that environment to have Musa. Ner Yisrael of Rudiman is his, Chaim Berlin is his, Reb Yaakov Kamenetsky is his Talmud. It's hard to think of anything of Torah today that's not him. And nobody knows anything about him. He was a totally anonymous person when it came to himself. He lived for 30 years without his family. He left his family in Kelm. He was in Slabodka and covenant to devote himself totally to the cause, and he would come home for Yontif, and that was it. I don't know what for 30 years, why he put what whatever it was, but that was his person. In 1925, the government had a draft, an army draft, that they used to pati yeshiva bachrim. They stopped patting yeshiva bachrim in 1925, and they realized they can't. I mean, going to the army in those days was suicide. It was horrendous. The conditions were horrendous. Yiddishkeit was impossible. It was horrible. So, and there are just so many Bochum that could pass off as cripples. You know, there's just how many Bochum could manage to get out. So he took a group of Bochum to Eretz Yisrael, together with Moshe Mordechai Epstein, and they founded Chevron Yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael. The Alta lived till 1927 and was Nifta, and that's that branch of it. Staying in Slabotka, Rabbi Isaac Shar came back. That was a son-in-law of his. But Avraham Grudzinski was a Talmud Muvok. He came back as Mashkiach, and they led the yeshiva until the war. Rabbi Avraham Grudzinski was killed at Kiddush Hashem. We'll see in the 7th, 4th, in one of the two places. No, they burnt the hospital down with him together. That my father remembers that, unfortunately. And Rabbi Isaac Shar made it to Eretz Yisrael and started Slabotka yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael. Al-Kaponim, there's a passage in Kehelas, it says that there was a city that was enclosed, that was surrounded, encircled, and a Chacham Echad came, and he saved the city with Chachma, and nobody remembered the person. And everybody asked, how could it be that somebody saves the whole world and nobody remembers him? So people do know the Alta Slabotka, the name is famous, but his own wish was to have nothing of himself ever public, and that's pretty much Mekuyim. He did not, nothing about his own personal life, his own real thoughts, or there. Now, I just say over something we were talking about at the table about Tisha B'Av, and the Rebbe Chaber was about Sinas Chinam. I just happened to see recently the Alta said a shmuz about Tisha B'Av. He said, you know, Tisha B'Av because of Sinas Chinam. And because, you know, so on and so forth. He said, so on Tisha B'Av during Kinnis, instead of calling on you to do Arzei Levanon, they call somebody else to do Arzei Levanon. So you're Eish Lahava on the Gabbai, Eish Lahava on the person that took away the Arzei Levanon from you, and you're, so he said, so that's really where people are. His Musa Shemuzin, but basically, they were tremendous drua. Most of them were very, 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 very clear descriptions of what people's emotions are like, their mindset. You almost could read minds. Let me add maybe just another question. I mentioned a story. One of the Litvish tchunis was dignity was very important. Honor was also very important. And people were very sensitive to slights to honor. That was part of Litvish mindset. So if you got a lesser aliyah, it was somebody's putting you down, somebody that. And that's where the altar put a lot of focus. All of the shittas you hear about the Alta, about that he liked the Bochum to be spiffy and to be dressed and to be nice and so on and so forth, very unclear. He was meticulously clean, he was meticulously dignified, but the shtariness of the Bochum, that probably was because he felt that the Bochum needed it. And everybody else, university Bochum university students walked around stolz with a big chup and you know, this golden glasses and looking very, very chashev. He felt it was important. Did he believe that's what he should be? No way to know. He himself did not. He wasn't into the latest model of suits or whatever it is. He was very clean, very dignified, meticulously so, but what he felt about, he felt it was important. And whatever you saw in yeshiva, the only thing you knew about it is that he held it's important for the dough. Al-Kaponim, so in many ways, so Volozhin is like the first layer of the floor of the yeshivas, the basic concept of people coming together, having a rav, learning b'chavrusa, and learning b'di b'chaverim. Slabotka is the closest to what we have, that there's a certain proactive reaching out to the Bachrim. The mesechtas that were learned that would encourage the most competitiveness, the type of interaction where there's a guiding hand from the top to try to shape and mold Bachram and bring it to a certain place, that was his. And the idea that Musar is part of yeshiva, bringing in the right type of Bachram to see the yeshiva so that it grows around it, that was him. And came out of everything that went into the other yeshivas, it either mirrored what he said or he was behind it somehow. It's incredible that this person, in a sense, saved Torah. This was the next generation of Torah. The next generation of Torah did not reflect the old school, not reflect Volozhin. It reflected him, the flavor of the yeshiva, the tzur of the yeshiva, the content of the yeshiva. Everything about it was a reflection of the Alta's molding of it. And it saved Lithuanian Jewry was only open to that. Divrei Teichacha about keeping mitzvahs no longer worked anymore. You needed to have whatever it is that he brought. And so in a certain sense, Kovno was a big city, but Slabodka is where Yiddish life came from. And this is where what we have today, the Olma Torah, is from there. Okay.
The Golden Legacy, collection of essays.
Yeah.
About, I think it's about 8 or 11.